The slow month of June continues, but there never is a slow month in the NFL. We'd spent a lot of time recently talking about a first-round quarterback with the first letter M, second letter A in his last name, Manziel. He'd been the lead item on this program multiple times. Now it's back to a guy who was drafted 31 years ago, Dan Marino. Big news yesterday, although I don't know what the news really is, other than Marino has joined the litany of former players who have filed suit against the NFL for concussions. And this one gets very confusing very quickly because Marino is represented by one of the lead lawyers who brokered the still pending settlement, a settlement more than 9 months old that is yet to receive preliminary approval from Judge Anita Brody. The case was filed in the same court where the settlement is pending. Unless Marino has decided that he wants to push his rights in the same court where the settlement is pending with one of the lawyers who brokered it and ignore that settlement and go forward on his own, he didn't need to file this lawsuit because he's already part of the settlement. And if he does want to go his own way, why in the world are you filing the lawsuit where the case is currently pending with one of the lawyers who is leading the charge for the settlement? And look, I can speak from experience. As a lawyer who handles a lawsuit, once a settlement is reached, you move on to something else. You don't want to continue to tilt at that same windmill. You have moved on. You have other cases to work on. So it's a strange situation because it really doesn't change Dan Marino's status at all unless he really does want to go his own way, which, again, makes no sense because why would you be using one of the lawyers who brokered the settlement and be filing in the court where the settlement is pending? And this all happens at a time when, as Peter King explained, Dan Marino is deep in discussions with the Dolphins about joining the team again. He'd had a very minor cup of coffee with the Dolphins 10 years ago or so. Why would you sue the league, which includes the Dolphins, if you're getting ready to go work for the Dolphins, if it doesn't in any way affect your rights that previously existed? None of this makes any sense, and it calls into further question the idea that plenty of guys who are in broadcasting who played in the NFL may, if they weren't indirectly receiving money from the NFL or as a result of the NFL's ongoing efforts, may join the concussion litigation. But again, you don't need to. Unless you want to take a stand, unless you want to reject the settlement, unless you want to push this separately, there's no reason to do anything. You just enter the settlement. You don't have to take a stand. You don't have to issue a press release. You just do nothing. And then you get evaluated by the doctors who are going to be put in place to determine who's got the serious mental impairments, who doesn't, who gets the settlement money, who doesn't. There's nothing controversial about that at all. This is just a weird, strange, bizarre situation that has very little clarity at this point. But it has resulted in a bit of a PR hit for Dan Marino at a time when it's really not clear where he is going with his connection to the NFL, other than to join one of the 32 teams that are part of the league that he has now sued, perhaps unnecessarily. We're going to try to continue to figure this out. I don't know that we can. I just spent 3+ minutes chasing my tail, if I have one. Maybe some think I do, be that as it may, this really is a confusing development. And some think that it means that the current settlement is moving closer to approval. This may be an effort by the lawyer who filed the lawsuit, Saul Weiss, to get more names under his name as plaintiffs who have filed suit so that it will help him get more money when it's time to cut up the massive nine-figure award of attorney's fees. Attorney's fees will be incurred on behalf of Bills defensive tackle Marcell Dareus. Just a couple of weeks ago, he was arrested in Alabama on felony charges of possession of synthetic marijuana. If you don't know what synthetic marijuana is, look it up. It's a troubling trend now. It's kind of like the new bath salts, law enforcement catching up with it. Law enforcement caught up with Marcell Dareus, both figuratively and literally, because on Friday, just 2 days after he kind of tweaked the media for taking this prior arrest out of context. I mean, it's always our fault for, God forbid, pointing out things that happened. What happened was he was arrested on multiple charges related to alleged car racing. Coach Doug Marone, due to address the Dareus situation during the hour, we'll have an update at ProFootballTalk.com. One of my guys is paying attention to the various vehicles, no pun intended, really, for finding out what Marone has to say, and we'll post it. But Dareus absent from today's OTA practice. We'll see what the Bills do. We've seen a trend in recent years where teams are more likely to issue discipline on their own and then the league just kind of sits back and lets that play out. So we'll see. Will the Bills discipline Darius? Will the league discipline him? Keep in mind, he's now a multiple offender, but it's a first-time offense under either of the two main policies. Offender under the substance abuse policy, potentially, allegedly, for possession of synthetic marijuana, and an offender under the personal conduct policy for this alleged car racing incident. But multiple incidents can result in discipline being accelerated. We've seen the NFL do that before when there have been multiple incidents under different policies. Multiple incidents have gotten guys like Josh Gordon of the Browns and Darrell Washington of the Cardinals in serious trouble under the substance abuse policy. And as this Washington situation has hit the radar screen and the Josh Gordon suspension reportedly, allegedly continues to percolate, I think we need to remember the Jim Irsay situation. And here's where I'm getting at. First, you've got Chris Carter saying that Josh Gordon places a greater priority on marijuana than football. And I hear that all the time. Teams don't care if guys smoke marijuana. They just hope that guys will choose football over marijuana once they're in the program. If you're in the program and you keep smoking, you're going to get caught and you're not going to be able to eventually play football and earn the money that goes along with it. And then you've got the Darrell Washington situation, who repeatedly was caught, who repeatedly chose marijuana over football. And now his head coach is just mad about the whole situation. He doesn't want to talk about it anymore. Here's Bruce Arians from Monday.
We will not talk about guys who are not with us ever again. We're obviously hope that Darrell gets his life straightened out, but he also was very unaccountable to his teammates, the organization, the fans, and everybody else. So from this point forward, after today, I've already told the players there'll be no questions answered about Darrell Washington. He's no longer with us. We'll talk about the guys who are here practicing and are getting ready to play for the Cardinals this year. And that's pretty much it.
Strong, forceful stuff from Bruce Arians, but it presumes that Darrell Washington actually was able to make a conscious choice to say, you know what, I'm going to let my teammates down, I'm going to let my coaches down, I'm going to let my family down, I'm going to let myself down by smoking that joint that is going to potentially cost me $6 million between bonuses and salary. And this is where we get to the question of whether or not we're talking about conscious choice of guys or guys who have a real problem. And that brings me back to Irsay. There's been a theory percolating in league circles that maybe the upshot of the Jim Irsay situation will be that the NFL develops a greater sense of compassion to players who have real problems. And surely, Josh Gordon and Darrell Washington have problems. No one in their right mind is going to choose to smoke marijuana over earning the millions of dollars that come from playing football, over being exiled from the sport that they love, from being cast aside from their primary vehicle for earning a living. So maybe there's something more going on here that requires compassion, that requires treatment, that requires patience, and that maybe requires not casting a guy out into the wilderness for a full year. And if this is the track that the NFL is going to insist on using when it comes to players, they better set that same track up for Jim Irsay and anyone else. Even if Jim Irsay has an illness, even if Jim Irsay has a problem that can be corrected through treatment, etc. If he slips up at a certain point, he's gone for a year. And tough talk from everybody involved. He let us down. He made bad choices, etc. At some point, we got to break away from that and maybe recognize these aren't really choices. There really aren't guys so stupid that they would smoke that one final joint and give up millions of dollars. And to the extent that Irsay gets that compassion, maybe we need to get to the point where the players get that too. And they aren't thrown aside for a year simply because they continue to give in to a very real problem. Coming up, what do we got next? We have Torrey Holt, former Rams receiver, member of the Greatest Show on Turf, joining us to talk about a variety of things. But I've got this ridiculous suit on for PFT Live because we're going to use portions of the interview on tonight's program, because we continue to delve into the Prime Numbers series. Tonight is number 88, and that is a number that Torrey Holt wore very effectively early in his career, and then he ditched it. Intriguing story from Torrey Holt coming up as to why he changed jerseys. Hopefully it's intriguing. I assume it's intriguing. I wouldn't risk the jinx of giving up my jersey after 3 years. We'll see why Torrey did that, and we'll talk to him about other things. And then we'll talk to Sam Farmer, the LA Times, about what in the world's going on in Los Angeles. I mean, you've got a very good report from Tim Graham of the Buffalo News saying that that LA is basically dead as the destination for an NFL team. And then you've got Stephen Ross of the Dolphins and Arthur Blank of the Falcons making it seem like the NFL is going to be back there sooner rather than later. No one better than Sam Farmer to help us figure out where the truth resides in that regard. But before we talk to Sam, we'll talk to Torrey Holt. We'll do that after the break. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. He was a member of the greatest show on turf. I cannot believe it's been 15 years since we were introduced to the St. Louis Rams that rocketed through the NFL and won the NFL championship. Torrey Holt joins us now. Torrey, can you believe it's been 15 years since the greatest show on turf took the NFL by storm?
Oh, man, it's amazing how time flies. But it's interesting. I just got an email today. Well, a text today from Kurt talking about our 15th year anniversary that's coming up this year and some of the plans that he has and some of the plans that the Rams have. So it's amazing how time flies. But I'm so happy and so thankful and humbled to have been a part of that ball club and the greatest show on turf. And that name sticks. It's in history and it'll never go away. And it feels really good to be a part of that.
And at one point, it looked like 1999 was going to be a complete debacle for the Rams. Trent Green tears an ACL in the preseason. Enter Kurt Warner, who no one had heard of. When did you first sense that despite what had happened, something special was going to occur?
Well, I noticed something special when I first went to OTAs and mini camp. And when I got there, I was like, wow, how was this team a three-win team the year before with all the talent that was on the football field and then how they drafted, and then we were able to bring in Adam Timmerman, we were able to bring in Marshall Faulk with a trade with the Colts. I knew right then we had an opportunity to be really special if we worked hard, put it all together in those mini camps and in those OTAs. And then we got the training camp. Things just started to click. Things just started to roll. Coach Martz had an outstanding system in place with guys that could run the system, guys that could learn, and guys that were very efficient and very serious about their craft and their work. I knew right away we could be really special, even when Trent went down, because when Kurt would come in and replace Trent with some of the reps, we were rolling. You know, the ball never hit the ground. We never skipped a beat. Now, Coach Martz was tough on Kurt, but we never skipped a beat. You know, we had talent all across the board, offensive line, the skill positions, a really good ball club. So I noticed early on that we could be a very special football team, and we went on to improve that.
One of the main reasons we want to talk to you, Torrey, is because we're focusing on some of the best players to wear number 88. That apparently was not your number of choice when you came to St. Louis. You'd worn 81 at NC State. How did you end up in 88?
Well, 88, Lynn Swann wore 88. Marvin Harrison wore 88. My Uncle Charles wore 88 when he was in high school, and he played tight end. He was probably about 5'11", 165 pounds, soaking wet, but he was tough. He could catch, reliable. So when I got to St. Louis, and 81 wasn't available because Oz Akeem was wearing 81, and then I didn't want to shell out any money to get 81. I figured, hey, give me 88. I'll make the number. My Uncle Charles wore the number. He represented the number well. Lynn Swann, like I said, Marvin Harrison, those guys. Michael Irvin wore 88. So I figured, hey, you know, there's some great players that's worn 88. And then I had a great admiration for my uncle. So give me 88. I'll make the number. I'll rock it. Make it special. And in my first couple of years, two or three years that I wore 88, I was able to, you know, do some pretty good things in that number. So that's where 88 came about, from Lynn Swann, Michael Irvin, and then more importantly, my Uncle Charles.
So then, Torrey, how concerned were you when you decide after 3 years in the NFL, three great years in the NFL, to let 88 go and go back to 81? Were you jinxing yourself at that point?
No, you know what? I wasn't concerned at all. No doubt set in my mind about changing numbers when 81 came available. Oz went on to Detroit. 81 came available. a lot of people recognized me from the number 81. It resonated from my college days at NC State. So I wanted to get that number immediately. And then 8 + 1 = 9. I wore number 9 when I was in high school. And number 9 came about from Michael Jordan when he was playing in the Olympics. And I'm a huge Michael Jordan fan. And I wanted to wear that 9, you know, so I can try to be like Mike. But 81 came available in St. Louis. I jumped on it. And my play just continued to roll. But there was no doubt that I would have any setbacks once I changed the number. And then when I changed the number, my pockets was able to fill up a little bit more, too, because now everybody had to switch from 88 to 81. So it was a good business decision. But more importantly, it was a number that that I respected, a number that resonated with Torrey Holt.
Did anyone ask for a refund because they bought your 88 jersey?
Yeah. I had several people come up to me saying, now that you switched your number, I need to get a refund back because I've been wearing 88 or I've been trying to get 88. But I was teased quite a bit about that. But my fans, they switched over to 81, and I was able to go on for the next 7 years wearing 81, doing really good things in St. Louis and representing the number well. You got to think about the guys that wore 81. Art Monk, who I love, played with the Washington Redskins. I was a huge Washington Redskins fan. Tim Brown, who I was a huge fan of, won the Heisman Trophy out there in Notre Dame, and then he went on to Oakland, had an outstanding career. Terrell Owens wore 81. You know what type of career he had. Later on, Randy Moss wore 81 when he was out with New England. So a lot of good players have rocked that number and have worn that number very well. And now we have a guy by the name of Calvin Johnson who's continuing to keep the number 81 alive.
You said earlier you initially didn't want to shell out any money to Oz Hakeem. What's the strangest story you've heard about a negotiation for a guy to get the number that he wanted?
Oh, man. I mean, I've heard guys spend as much as $1,000 all the way up to $100,000 just for a number. I just found that hard to shell out that kind of money for a number. And I never needed to have a conversation with Oz even about the number or even exchanging any dollar figures for the number. But those are the stories that I've heard, guys shelling out $1,000 anywhere up to $100,000 for a number. Again, that was something that I didn't want to do. You know, give me the number, I'll make the number. But that's one of the wildest stories that I've heard.
Looking back on that team that won the Super Bowl in the 1999 season, who would you say the best player was?
The best player was on that 99 team? I would say Marshall was probably one of the top players on our squad. I mean, he did everything for us. He caught the ball out of the backfield. He ran the ball in between the tackle. I mean, outside with the tackles. He ran the ball inside between the guards and the centers. He was really, really good in pass pro. Very smart, very knowledgeable of the offense. I would say Marshall Faulk probably was the top player on that ball club. But we had a lot of good players. You know, not only Marshall, you know, Isaac, Orlando, Kurt, myself. The list goes on and on of guys that were Hall of Fame caliber players. Now, I didn't know that during the time when I was playing because I was just so excited about going out and playing and competing and doing the best that I could to help our ball club, not knowing that I was playing with so many Hall of Fame caliber players on that ball club. So I was fortunate as a rookie to come in and see pros. I was fortunate enough to come in as a rookie and see pros doing it the way it was supposed to be done.
So how many make it to Canton when it's all said and done?
Excuse me?
How many of the guys from that team make it to Canton?
Obviously Marshall is in there. Kurt should be in there soon. Orlando Pace should be in there soon. Isaac Bruce will be in there really soon. I'll be up for the Hall of Fame as well. Hopefully I'll get an opportunity to get in as well. I think 4 or 5 guys legitimately have an opportunity to be in Hall of Fame caliber players from that ball club. Aeneas Williams came on with us in 2001, and now he's going into the Hall of Fame. So that's at least 6 players right there, possibly, potentially, that can be inducted into the National Football Hall of Fame. An outstanding group of ball players, like I said, pros that came out and played the game the right way, practiced, paid attention to details, were just pros all the time. Was really good for myself and other young players. We had somebody, or we had guys to look up to see how it was done consistently the right way all the time.
Do you think you would have won more Super Bowls if Coach Vermeil hadn't retired after winning that first one?
Yeah, I think we should have won more Super Bowls. You know, it'd be, you know, I always go back and forth, you know, how would it have been if Coach Vermeil would have stayed on as the head coach and Coach March would have stayed there as the offensive coordinator. But Coach March was an outstanding head coach as well. And we had an opportunity to win in 2001. We fell short. But, yeah, I do think we should have won more Super Bowls with that, with those teams that we had, with the players that we had. I think we should have won at least three or four Super Bowls. I mean, we were a very talented football team, a very well-oiled machine offensively. We could score with anybody, the best of them. And then defensively, when we brought over Lovie Smith and Aeneas and those guys, we could stop teams. And not only did we stop teams, we were able to score points on defense with what we were doing on offense. So we were a very potent team. I would have loved to seen us go on and win more Super Bowls. But, I mean, you know the history and the story of what happened there in St. Louis. We had some turmoil there in the front office, and then things started to kind of fall apart. But to answer your question, we should have won more Super Bowls in St. Louis with those ball clubs that we had.
And a couple of your teammates continue from time to time to mention Super Bowl 36, maybe some shenanigans by the Patriots. Do you have any opinions on whether or not that win by the Patriots in Super Bowl 36 was in any way tainted?
Well, you know what? I mean, my teammates have spoke out about that publicly enough. I don't really have to say any more about it. You know, I just think it's unfortunate, you know, if they did decide to cheat to beat us. You know, I go back and forth, you know, about that as well. At the end of the day, they outplayed us to go out and win that ball game. So I just kind of keep it at that.
Tell us what the Hope Brothers Foundation has coming up this month, Torrey.
The Hope Brothers Foundation, we support young kids with a parent that's dealing with cancer. We're really excited about our foundation and our mission and the efforts that we have going forward. We have Hope Brothers Football. We have a football camp June 28th here in Raleigh, North Carolina at Dale Practice Facilities at NC State. Again, June 28th. To find out more information, you can go on to hopebrothersfootball.com. Sign up, come out. It's a one-day camp. It's a lot of energy, very active, a lot of skills. London Fletcher will come out and help us out this year. Isaac Bruce, Corey Chavis, Tyquan Underwood, former and current players will come out and help us teach these kids the right way how to play the game of football. And hopefully they'll continue to keep our great game going as it is.
Well, great stuff, Torrey. Thanks so much for your time. Hope to talk to you again down the road.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. All the best.
All right, there he is, Torrey Holt, formerly of the St. Louis Rams, long time there, had a season with the Jaguars, and then actually was with the Patriots, but ended up on injured reserve. But one of the great receivers in NFL history, started with number 88, finished with number 81, and could finish with a bust in Canton. When we return, we're going to go from Canton all the way to Los Angeles, talk to Sam Farmer of the LA Times about where things really do stand with the NFL returning to Los Angeles after 20 years and counting. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. What's going on with the NFL in Los Angeles? Who the hell knows? So we have one guy that we can go to help us figure it all out. Who better than Sam Farmer of the Los Angeles Times, who is joining us while flying a plane from the kitchen of his home. Sam, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Mike? Yeah, that's right. It's Major Tom here.
Yeah, that's right, man. Here we go. Major Tom, well, welcome to the program. And I can't make sense anytime Los Angeles comes up, but now we've got the Tim Graham piece in the Buffalo News a week or so ago that made it look like LA NFL dead in the water. Then you've got Stephen Ross of the Dolphins saying it's not just possibly or probably going to happen, it's a certainty within 5 years. Can you help us figure out where things currently stand with the NFL in LA and where it's heading?
Well, that's funny. Welcome to my life. I've lived this for the past 20 years now of people saying this moving five-year window that many owners, I mean, Stephen Ross is just the latest to jump on board. There are lots of owners, Jerry Jones among them, who have said this for some time. Go back 10 years ago, and it was in the next 5 years there will be a team. You know, it only gets tougher. Now, I'm not saying that it won't happen, but it only gets more difficult as the stadiums become more expensive. And, you know, people in LA become more and more accustomed, as they have been over the last 20 years, to getting their games on TV, and the league becomes increasingly accessible on TV and on the web, etc. And you know, something has changed this year, and that is that the Chargers, Rams, and Raiders, all of whom played in LA at one point, all of them are on essentially one-year stadium deals. And that's really interesting, creates an interesting environment. They've sort of evened up at the line now. And the fact that Stan Kroenke bought that 60 acres that sit, the 60 flat acres that sit between the Forum and Hollywood Park, 60 acres that could accommodate a stadium, makes it really interesting, because if the Rams and St. Louis can't agree to a deal, then Stan Kroenke could move that team to L.A. So that is a bit of a game changer, that you have an existing owner who buys a piece of land that could accommodate a stadium in Los Angeles. Now, probably couldn't handle all the parking on that 60 acres, but it is significant.
What kind of a relocation fee are we talking about if Stan Kroenke would move the Rams back to Los Angeles?
Well, that's interesting. I don't think the league has determined. Well, I know the league certainly hasn't publicly determined what the relocation fee would be. I think if it's a good deal for the league, they're not going to slap a prohibitive relocation fee on a team that would kill a good deal for the league. But remember, as I've said for years, and as you've said, LA has been extremely valuable to the NFL without a team as a leverage point to get deals done in other cities. So if the league were dying to have a team in Los Angeles, there'd be a team here already, and probably two. So LA is valuable without a team. LA is, you know, is valuable with the team. It's just that right now, with the Rams and St. Louis being so far apart in their bid and ask, it creates an interesting scenario that you have the owner of the Rams owning a big piece of land where he could put a stadium in Los Angeles, and a guy who has deep connections to Los Angeles in Stan Kroenke.
And Sam, the news last week that former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer intends to buy the LA Clippers for $2 billion dusted off pretty dramatically the talk of the NFL in LA from the standpoint of what would an NFL team be worth, and is there somebody that would now want to buy the Bills and move them to LA? All sorts of potential issues that arise from comparing an NFL team to a $2 billion B team at the NBA, at least as far as LA goes. Does it make it easier, or does it make it more complicated to get the NFL back to LA if one of the basketball teams there is worth $2
billion? Well, I really think it's comparing apples and oranges, and it was the same thing with the Dodgers when the Dodgers got a huge price. You know, of course, NFL owners' eyes are going to light up, but they know that a lot of that is based on building a TV network around a team like the Dodgers were able to do, and the value of that network, like the Yankees and the YES Network. You can't do that with an NFL team. You can't say that the LA team will be on this special TV network and nowhere else. And you know, we're talking about 16 games, and we're talking about a national TV deal. All these TV deals that the league has. So that's the intrinsic value of a team in a lot of respects, and the value of the Clippers, and also the portability of the team. How portable are the Clippers? Are they able to, say, at some point move that team back to Seattle? You know, all those things factor into the value of a team. I think the league has a pretty good bead on what a value of an LA franchise would be. And I don't think that you'd see the commensurate $3 billion LA franchise. I just don't think that would, as popular as the NFL is, because you're not selling a TV package. You're not selling a TV network built around that team.
How realistic, Sam, do you think it is for someone who's intent on moving a team to LA to purchase the Buffalo Bills, overpay for the Bills, and then basically lie to everybody in Western New York for the next 5 years that they're not moving, and then move the team to LA when that window opens in 2020?
I think it's hugely unrealistic, particularly with the Bills. You're talking about the only NFL franchise that plays in the state of New York, obviously a very powerful political state, and the league has deep political interests and lots of reasons why it wouldn't want to kick a hornet's nest in Washington with two very powerful senators and the interest in keeping a team in New York. And I just don't think that it would make sense to move the Bills to Los Angeles. And I think the league is sensitive to that for a lot of reasons. And also, you've got to look at the LA situation. Whatever team moves to Los Angeles, if it isn't the Chargers, Dean Spanos, the owner of the Chargers, is going to try to build a nine-owner coalition to block any move. Because once a team moves to L.A., not only are the Chargers playing in the shadow of a shiny new toy in L.A., and that hurts their product, but the Chargers lose all leverage to get a new stadium in San Diego. Because once the threat evaporates of them moving to Los Angeles, they've got no hammer to wield. So you've got a very strong opponent of any potential LA mover sitting there in San Diego saying, look, I've tried for a dozen years. I've exhausted every possible option to get a new stadium. I've got to have LA as an option. And if I don't, then I'm just going to rot down here. So Dean Spanos has had 12 years to build a coalition to block any potential move. Now, could he block any potential move? That's debatable, because if it's a move that's good for the NFL, maybe owners defect from that block and say, Dean, you're on your own. This is good for the league. This is good for me. But something you have to take into consideration is the Chargers are going to throw their body in front of any moving van that's coming toward L.A.
But here's the way I look at it, because if Stan Kroenke is able to build a stadium at that property that he's purchased in between Hollywood Park and the Forum, why not just have the Chargers move to that stadium? Problem solved. Somebody else is paying for the stadium. We go play there. We move back to L.A. And that would seem to be an easy solution. And we hear all the time that eventually it would be two teams in L.A.
Yeah, well, the NFL is going to continue to hold out the notion, and will always hold out the notion that LA is a two-team market, both because it probably could accommodate two teams, and it has in the past, and also once you take away one leverage point, you can still maintain another by saying, well, there's still a vacancy in LA. Yes, we have a team there, but there's still a vacancy in LA. The longer, and this sort of plays to what Stephen Ross says, the longer we go with leases maturing and teams being able to get out of their lease, stadiums getting older, cities potentially less willing to kick in public money for new stadiums, the more likely it is that LA ultimately will get a team. But another thing you have to consider, the league isn't going to drop two teams into L.A. in a three-year window. L.A. is a very volatile market, obviously. It's already lost three teams. It's a scary proposition for the league because it's so prohibitively expensive. It's hard to do business here, and this is a market that's lost teams, so it's not a turnkey market. So would you want to dump two teams in right away and tell the fan base, hey, divide your allegiances however you want. We're going to flood the market and hope to sell out games. I mean, that's kind of a scary proposition.
That fan base is already there to a certain extent for the Oakland Raiders, who were the LA Raiders for an extended period of time. I get the impression, though, that the NFL isn't thrilled with the idea of a Mark Davis-run Raiders franchise returning to L.A. Is that accurate?
Yeah, certainly the first team back. I don't think the Raiders would be the first team back. The Raiders introduced a new element, and that is you'd have to rebrand them for the LA market. They're leaving. When they left such a sour taste in the mouths of so many fans and politicians in Los Angeles that that's almost been the boogeyman for LA. Do you want the Raiders coming back? Do you want, you know, do you want that situation where you have the fights in the stands, et cetera? I mean, they would have to do a lot of rebranding work to be palatable to LA fans. Of course, they're going to have their hardcore Raider fans that are going to be devoted to the team. But you're talking about selling suites. You're talking about selling corporate sponsorships and those types of things. It's not just putting fans in the general admission seats. And so if you rebrand the Raiders, if you turn them from Hell's Angels into the Pirates of the Caribbean, are you gonna lose that original hardcore Raider fan base? I mean, you can't change the colors, you can't change the logo, do anything like that, and potentially that could be a real tough rebranding problem. You look at the Seahawks; they were able to rebrand under Paul Allen, but this is a much more significant one where it's sort of encrypted on the Raiders' DNA that they are the Outlaws, and I just don't know if that would sell to LA at large.
So ultimately then, let's focus on this. With Steve Ross, the owner of the Dolphins, saying that the NFL will certainly return to LA within 5 years, does he know what he's talking about, or is this just his clumsy way of making it up to his partners for crying uncle on multiple occasions while he tries to get public money unsuccessfully and ultimately pays for his own upgrades to his stadium, which kind of hurts the effort to get taxpayer dollars for other stadiums?
Well, I would say that he knows what he's talking about and that he's been in those meetings and he's privy to information that non-owners don't have. And yet, I don't think it's a unique statement to say that the NFL will be back in 5 years. I heard it in 2000. I heard it in 98. I heard it 2005. I've heard it throughout. You know, another thing you have to consider is it's very bad for the league if NFL is stagnant in LA and there's no activity at all, because even if a team isn't on its way to LA, you've got to keep the pot stirred to keep it viable as a leverage point. And the only thing that hurts the NFL is if Los Angeles is a still pool that where there's no activity. So in short, I you know, yes, a team could be back here in 5 years. I would sort of bet against it. I don't think there's going to be a team here in 5 years, but again, you know, it's going to happen at some point. And it's just, I will say though, it's getting tougher and tougher as it gets more expensive.
Well, great stuff, Sam. As always, we appreciate your time. We'll check out your work at the LA Times website. And for our friends who are in the LA area, go ahead and get the print edition. They still make those. Thanks, Sam, and talk again down the road.
Thanks, Mike. See you, bud.
All right, there he is, Sam Farmer, the LA Times. Yeah, I mean, we keep hearing all 5 years there's going to be a team. 5 years there's going to be a team. And he's right. You have to keep the pot stirred. And now we're seeing the pot be stirred by Arthur Blank of the Falcons for London. We've heard Robert Kraft, the Patriots, say that. It's always the owners talking about it, because who benefits from having the opportunity to use these other cities as leverage points when it's time to get public money for billionaire businesses? It's the billionaires who own those businesses. So that's it for today's edition of PFT Live. Thanks to Sam Farmer. Thanks to Tori Holt. Thanks to you for hanging with us. And we'll be back tomorrow for another edition of the program. Tonight, NBCSN's Pro Football Talk takes a look at the second number Tory Holt wear, the first number. I got it all screwed up, as usual. Number 88, the first number he wore. We already talked about the second number he wore. 88 tonight. Other numbers tonight, 63, I believe, if memory serves, and others. You just have to tune in to find out. We're going to touch on all of the 99 numbers plus 00 at some point over the remainder of the month and into early July. We'll do that again tonight, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time, NBCSN. We'll see you back again tomorrow. Until then, As I always say, check us out around the clock at ProFootballTalk.com. Have a good one.